recognize some of you. I'm teaching the second half of the course. I guess for all the latecomers, I'll just tell them and you that I'm in office 472, in case you guys want to talk to me outside of class. So the next week or so, the next seven lectures, are going to be largely about different ways, different aspects of thinking of the standard model as an effective field theory. So you've studied some effective field theories before in the standard model class. I think you looked at, I know you did the chiral Lagrangian with Mark Wise, right? So this was the theory where you have this field sigma, that was built out of all the mesons. So M has an eta plus pi with coefficients. I'm not going to, most numbers I will ignore. And then it has, these are the pi naughts, pi plus or minus. Maybe this is k bar. Anyway. So the chiral Lagrangian is an effective field theory for describing mesons. You also looked at the Fermi model, I think. Did you guys do the Fermi model for weak interactions? Very briefly. Okay, so I'll come back and spend a little bit of time on that one. Fermi model. So the Fermi model, since you may not remember it that well, is a model for describing weak decays. And you can extend it to weak scattering mediated by W's and Z's without actually talking about the W and Z before. So originally, Fermi proposed this structure long before a particle as heavy as the W or the Z had ever been produced. So you just have interactions that look like if this has a parity. This kind of interaction, and if you count the dimensions of these fermions, each field has a dimension 3/2, right? So the total mass dimension of this operator, 4 fermions is 6, good. And what's the total mass dimension of the Lagrangian density? 4, right. So this had better have a coefficient that has some mass scale in the denominator, and indeed it's suppressed by the W mass scale. So we'll derive this not with all the different fermions of the standard model, but in a toy model with just one fermion. But the point I want to make at this point, what is an effective field theory? These are both theories for subsets of the standard model that are only valid below a certain energy scale, right? So the chiral Lagrangian makes sense for energies less than about 4 pi times this constant F. That works out to be near the GeV scale, because F is around 100 MeV. So for sub-GeV energies, you can talk about meson interactions using this Lagrangian. And even though all of the interactions will wind up being suppressed by the scale F, so it has no renormalizable interactions, which are the ones you're most used to talking about. The Fermi model, only valid for energies less than the mass of the W. And in some cases, we can also put a 4. We should also think about putting a 4 pi out there, too. So these are two examples of effective field theories that you've seen. And I just want to go through this one, some aspects of both, refresh your memory about important features of them, and then talk about sort of toy standard models in the process, and thinking of the standard model itself as an effective field theory. So what that means, what some of the interesting operators are that arise, and motivate the physical effects that we'll be talking about for the rest of the week. So I guess probably most everybody is here now. All right, so So this is a good time to say just something general about the rest of the class. So my plan is to talk about flavor physics beyond the standard model for the next couple of days, then a little bit about neutrino masses, and some, and then finally the last sort of main topic will be anomalies and the strong CP problem, which strictly speaking aren't effective field theory problems at all, but I think talking about this does sort of set the stage for them. I'm open to changing the plan a little bit, so if there are different things that I didn't mention that you were really hoping to learn about, I'm more than happy to adjust the plan, especially if you tell me today or tomorrow after class. After that, I might be less happy. So just talk to me soon if there's something else that you'd rather hear about. For today, like I said, I'll just review some points here and talk about the physical effects of effective field theories in the standard model to motivate some of what we'll be doing in the next few classes and in the tutorial. So starting from the chiral Lagrangian, let's see. So I already introduced this field sigma built out of the mesons. And you guys probably remember, I think actually everything I'm going to say about the chiral Lagrangian. Mark also did, but it's been a while, so I want to refresh your memories. So just to get the notation right. So the Lagrangian we always write down for these sigma fields starts from this term. So sigma is a matrix. Okay, plus some other terms. Now why, this is a sort of weird form. It's not exactly what we're used to seeing. If you expand it out. Oh, thank you. Yes. Good. So why do we need, so this actually doesn't look, if you just linearize it, this looks like a normal kinetic term. No surprises there. But this whole exponentiated structure is a little funny. So why is that? Well, if we ignore, for starters, I'm going to ignore almost everything. Not quite everything. I'm going to ignore the masses of quarks. I'm going to ignore electromagnetic interactions. And I'm going to ignore weak interactions. So I'm going to set all of these to zero. Think first about the theory in this limit. This is a really useful technique, is to just get rid of a bunch of interactions, see how what symmetries the theory has when you ignore those interactions, and then build them back in and see how they change the theory. So in this limit where you ignore these, then the theory of light quarks, that's the sort of those are the constituents that build up these mesons. You've got up quarks, down quarks, and strange quarks. And I'm going to assume that these are just fold. I'm going to not worry too much about the left versus right-handed quarks for this context, because I don't have weak interactions. They're not that different. But I can also rotate them separately. The only interaction in their Lagrangian is the usual kinetic term. Right, so I could write it in Dirac notation as a sidebar up del slash plus I E, and this guy has a color index, and so I have some gluon field that has those two color indices, and then he gets slashed times psi up plus the same exact thing for the up for the downs. And for the strangers, no electromagnetic interactions. Sorry, this E should be a G3. No electromagnetic interactions, no weak interactions, no quark masses to tell them apart. And in fact, if I broke this down further into the left and right-handed components, then I'd have my left. So let me just call this guy. Let me write this in a way that makes that symmetry manifest. So I'll just call these psi q, I. And if I like, I can call this guy qj. Just put it a 1, ij, just to remind me that this is really proportional to an identity matrix in the quark space. And then I need to sum over I and j. Usually I'll leave these sums over indices implicit. I can talk about my qi left, and then I'd have a sigma dot del if I'm working in Weyl spinner notation. I'd have just a sigma matrix instead of a gamma matrix. So sigma dot del plus ig3 sigma dot g psi q left plus, I could write down left-handed spinners for the right-handed anti-quarks as well, right? So I'm going to have my q left and my q right conjugate. Yeah, Trevor?
So this Lagrangian, what are the dot, dot, dots there? Are they the Yukawa terms or?
Sorry, now there's no, the dot, dot, dots were the down and strange quark kinetic terms. So actually, that's it.
So this is the QCD Lagrangian.
This is the QCD Lagrangian neglecting all of this.
Right.
And I should write down my G mu nu, trace of G mu nu, kinetic term. And that's it, right? So this is a very simple Lagrangian. I can take the kinetic term. I can write it in terms of these two-component quarks. And let me be consistent here with my notation. Let me just start calling these guys Q left I. Q left I, so now I don't have so many extraneous symbols lying around. And then I'm going to have my Q bar. These are for my Q conjugate right. Sigma dot del now these are effectively, these are color triplets. These are anti-quarks, the left-handed spinners, if I write and write things exactly the same way. These are anti-quarks, so they basically have the opposite color charges. I'm being a bit schematic by just putting this in as a minus one rather than a matrix. Point is, it's different. I still have the sigma dot g for the q right conjugates plus, and then I've got my g squared term. Okay, so, and yeah, this should have a minus fourth on it, but that's a coefficient. I'm ignoring those. Now this has clearly a very large symmetry, right? I can't rotate left-handed quarks into right-handed anti-quarks because they have different color charges. And we're interested in the regime where QCD is becoming very strong, so we really shouldn't be ignoring G3. But since I'm ignoring everything else, I can rotate all the left-handed quarks into each other, all the right-handed quarks into each other. What that does to the sigma field is that it takes sigma to some v left sigma v right dagger, where v left and v right are arbitrary unitary matrices. Yeah?
So Mark defined the charge conjugation, but in the Dirac notation. Is there an easy way to define the charge conjugation here in the two-component notation?
So in the two-component notation, the charge, you really think of the charge conjugate as a distinct particle, right? So in other words, we work with the charge conjugated guy as the fundamental entity, rather than, so that way we're working with left-handed spinners as our basic things all the time. Okay. So this is familiar, right? This transformation of sigma? Is it ringing bells for everybody? Any questions so far? Yeah.
So we don't have the couple between the left-handed and right-handed?
A coupling between them?
The
right-handed and left-handed,
Yeah, what about them?
I mean, in the Lagrange that you asked people, you had to cross them?
I never cross them, right? So I have a term that's quadratic in lefts and a term that's quadratic in rights, and that's it. Now, QCD, and I wasn't planning to spend much time on this, although Mark gave a very nice physical explanation of it, QCD does lead to this condensate that in a sense where the vacuum connects them, right? Where there's an expectation that you could write down the matrix, Q left, Q right conjugate, it's color singlet, and it takes a vacuum expectation value. That links the left and the right. That's what motivates building a sigma that has both a left and a right built into it. But the Lagrangian, the perturbative Lagrangian itself, does not actually mix left and right at all. Does that answer your question? Can you talk a little louder? I'm actually having trouble hearing because your rows back.
I still don't understand why we don't have a mix between the right-handed and left-handed.
Are you asking why we don't?
Yeah.
Good. So mass terms do mix the left and the right-handed, but I've ignored the mass terms. And kinetic terms are always diagonal, left-handed to right-handed. Okay? Do you want me to work through that more slowly, like going from the Dirac spinners, or?
It's okay.
Okay. good. So we're building a sigma field. It transforms under both the left and the right-handed symmetries. Now this places, and our Lagrangian has to be invariant under both of these symmetries. That places a huge restriction on what kinds of interactions you can have, right? First of all, you have a matrix. You need to get a scalar Lagrangian out of it, so you're going to have to take traces at the end of the day. But inside that trace, if you had a trace of sigma sigma, that would be no good, because it would transform, you know, it would have a V left sigma, V right dagger, V left sigma, V right dagger. That's not simplifying at all. It's not invariant. It's only, that's no good, if I took trace of sigma, sigma dagger, or if I could take a product of them, then that's going to transform to a V left sigma V right dagger. And then the sigma dagger, I have to reverse this when I dagger it. So it goes to a V right sigma dagger V left. Now these are unitary matrices. So that's one. It's an identity matrix. Sorry, I needed to dagger him too. And because this is a trace, I can cycle the V left around, group them together, and that's again proportional to the identity matrix. This is invariant. Unfortunately, if you look back up the definition of sigma, it was also a unitary matrix. So sigma sigma dagger is equal to, this is just the trace of the identity matrix, which is 3. So 3 is an invariant quantity that I can put into my Lagrangian. Haven't made much progress in writing down interactions. The only way I can write down interactions, they still have to be made out of these sigmas, but now to get something non-trivial, I have to put derivatives in. Every sigma-sigma dagger pair, I need to put in derivatives. So the full Lagrangian, if you ask what are those dot, dot, dots, I can extend that, but only by things with more derivatives. So I can write down things like a trace of del mu sigma dagger. And then I can square that trace. Now, what's his mass dimension for this operator? 4. Good. So put that in with some coefficient that has mass dimension 0. I can do something similar. There's actually 3 combinations that I can write down with 3 flavors of quarks. You know, one of them is to just put the square inside of a single trace, for example, then there's other index structures that I can do. Gotta do something with this chord. Okay, so these are now in the symmetry limit, right, where I've set all the quark masses to zero and I've set G1 and G2 to zero. These are the only kinds of interactions I can write down, plus one more. And these have dimensionless coefficients. So you might at first think, oh, those look like nice renormalizable interactions. But when you expand this out into the field that has a canonical kinetic term, which isn't sigma, it's m, what are you going to get? So that Lagrangian, let me just work on a clean board for now. I'll just erase it. So when I write this in terms of the mesons, what I'm going to get, so the first term, he has a kinetic term in it. Just a half no mu m. I don't think there's a half there at the end of the day. Plus, that's canonical kinetic term. Then, in my expansion of sigma, so let me just Taylor expand del mu sigma. Of course, the derivative on 1, the first term of this Taylor expansion, is 0. So I've just got 2i over f times del mu m plus, sorry, minus, then I've got a half 2i plus a half 2i over f squared del mu of m squared. And I could simplify him to minus 4 over f squared m del mu m, right? So now when I look at my kinetic term, it's also going to have, well, you might think there's a cubic term in the meson field from the quadratic piece of sigma and the linear piece of sigma dagger. But then there's also another cubic term from the linear piece of sigma and the quadratic piece of sigma dagger. Those exactly cancel each other. So the first thing you get is quadratic terms. And these quadratic terms look like, sorry, just a second. M equals M dagger is a Hermitian object, so I should just be writing that with a half out front. So these quadratic terms, they're going to look like m del mu m squared, and then they have an overall coefficient of that goes like 1 over some fixed number, which I'm just not working out for you, over f squared. Okay? This coefficient is fixed once you've normalized the kinetic term. There's no free parameter there. This is all, and then there's higher order. This is all from the kinetic term. Now, from that second term, from that C1 term, now even, this has 4 sigmas in it, so even if we expand each sigma just to linear order, we're gonna get something with 4 mesons in it. And so you see that you're gonna get things that look like 1 over proportional, again, some number times each of the CIs over f to the fourth. You get 1 over f from each sigma del mu m to the fourth. And there's different index structures that you'd get from each of these CIs. So if we ask ourselves a question about, say, pi-pi scattering, we're ignoring electromagnetic interactions. The only way the pions scatter is through these interactions. The matrix element for pi-pi goes to pi-pi. This is true for whether they're pions or kaons or whatever, charge, neutral. There's a coefficient coming from, I mean, all of these guys still have traces around them in some form. Right? So there's going to be a coefficient dependent on the matrix algebra that depends on what kind of pion or kaon you are. But the basic structure is going to have this coefficient. That's going to go like an energy scale squared over F squared with a fixed coefficient plus, in terms of these CIs, sum over I equals 1 to 3 for those three coefficients of numbers times scale energy to the fourth over F to the fourth. This coefficient is totally fixed just by the symmetry of the problem. And this structure here, right, these are highly complicated. You can write down a lot of energy-dependent functions. You've got the three Mandelson variables, and you can square them. So there's a whole lot of combinations here. The symmetry is restricting you to just having three different combinations. The symmetry of the problem is almost fully, but not completely, dictating the structure of the interactions. Right? You still have to measure these coefficients in order to know what they are. Yeah?
Are these the same coefficients as those?
These CIs
no.
are the CIs, C1 and C2, and the C3 up there. Good. So there's a systematic expansion you can do. If you didn't know about the CIs at all, and you just had a very low energy pi-pi scattering experiment, you would predict the answer to be this. Then you'd start seeing deviations. You'd say, okay, if I want to model these deviations, you'd have to do two things, actually. One thing you'd have to do is you'd have to add these free parameters CI. The other thing you'd have to do is you'd have to start putting these guys in loops. You'd have to start thinking about loops like that, where each one of these has an E squared over F squared. And so then the product has the same strength as that. And as you want higher and higher precision in E over F, you would need to keep including more terms. But for any given order of precision you want, you have a systematic procedure to work with. So all of this, you know, it's true that theories with just renormalizable interactions are special because you can get arbitrary precision by systematic rules from a finite number of parameters. Yeah?
So when I'm doing the loop diagrams, where do I cut off my loop, my integrals?
So you should cut things off at F.
F.
So for a finite degree of precision, you can still do exactly the same thing. Pick your level of precision. There's a systematic expansion with a finite number of parameters to get there. And you can fit to those parameters and then move on. Now, of course, this was a toy chiral Lagrangian. I set all of those things that are non-zero to zero. In the real world, you can add. But the reason this was a useful starting point is that when you want to talk about, say, electromagnetic scattering, you want to talk about weak interactions, you want to talk about the quark masses, you put them in as what are called spurions, explicit breaking, but in a controlled way, of that symmetry. So for example, for the quark mass, you put in the quark, for the quark mass, you add a trace of, term linear in sigma with a quark mass in it, because this quark mass is breaking those left and right-handed symmetries, lets you write down some non-invariant thing, then he ends up being proportional to a coefficient, which I guess Mark called V, because it's like a VEV, setting a scale of the breaking, and then of the chiral symmetry. And then you see that to make up the rest of the mass dimension, you need an F squared. It's over some order one number. So we put in explicitly the quark mass as a source, as an explicit parameter in the theory that breaks our symmetry. And we can do the same thing with the electroweak interactions. Incorporate them into the same systematic low energy expansion. All right, so that is the chiral Lagrangian in a nutshell.
Could I, sorry.
Yeah.
The V, is that related to the QCD scale?
It is related to the QCD scale. It's not the same as the lambda of the QCD scale, but it is related to how much QCD breaks the chiral symmetry spontaneously. So you can think of that V as if there were no Higgs, if there were no fundamental Higgs in the theory, then the you'd still, by QCD confining, it would break SU2 left. And that would be the Higgs VEV in that theory, where it's just QCD breaking SU2. So, okay, Fermi model. So let me just motivate this first with a simple matrix element that you guys have calculated before, which is mu on decay. So this is going to be just a theory. I'm going to do a simple version. Just a theory of electrons, muons, and neutrinos. Actually, let me... So let me. There's a point I want to make about how this differs from the Fermi model. So I said both of these are theories to describe the degrees of freedom below some cutoff. So in the Fermi model, we had electrons, muons, and neutrinos. And we're going to write down a Lagrangian that's valid below the mass of the W. Above the mass of the W, we have electrons, muons, and neutrinos, and W's. Not much of a change of the degrees of freedom. We just added one. The others are perturbative degrees of freedom. They're exactly the same. That's very different from the situation we had in the chiral Lagrangian, where below a scale F, we have these meson fields. Above the scale F, we have gluons and quarks. Right, so this is an example of a perturbative effective theory. This is a non-perturbative effective theory, where the degrees of freedom are actually changing. In this case, because it's perturbative, we can actually do calculations to infer parameters. If we know the full theory, which we do, we have the benefit of living after the standard model, then we can do calculations to figure out what the parameters are down here. In QCD, we don't know any perturbative of any way of calculating these coefficients perturbatively. There are matrix, there are lattice simulations that you can do to get access to some of them, but that's like, you know, almost like doing a Monte Carlo of the system and doing a measurement on it. There's no perturbative calculation that relates them. So here we will be able to do that. That's what I want to do. If we just consider a muon decay, right? So in the standard model, we model muon decay. Muon goes to a muon neutrino. And then through a W, it goes to an electron and an electron antineutrino. And if you ask what the matrix element is, well, you're going to have a coefficient here, which is, it's a G2 over root 2 times you have some, I'll do this in Dirac spinners. So you've got some U bar, the momentum of the muon neutrino, gamma mu, left-handed projector, right? So this is just 1 minus gamma 5 over 2. On the muon, sorry, pbu. Got a similar term for the electron. Where now I have I think I got all my u's and v's right. And then I better multiply in the w propagator, which is just going to have a, sorry, so let me call this guy nu, a g mu nu minus q mu q nu over mw squared over q squared minus mw squared, where q is this momentum here, the momentum of the virtual w. So hopefully this looks familiar to everybody, right? Now, let's see, do you guys mind if I hide the chiral Lagrangian for this board? So now Q, I mean, Q is this is a muon decaying, right? Muon mass is 100 MeV. So the magnitude of the Q energy is bounded by the muon mass, and the momentum also ends up being bounded by the muon mass. So Q is a very small number, right? So to a good approximation, we can just replace that propagator piece with a g mu nu over mw squared. We can just guess from that simple form, if I do that replacement, now there's no momentum dependence in the matrix element, except for the wave functions. It looks like it's coming from a pointed direction. I could have written an effective Lagrangian that just had a g2 squared over 2mw squared, and then mu, I'm just going to write down the interaction terms, not the kinetic terms. So I'd have my mu gamma mu p left nu bar mu e gamma mu p left nu bar e really he should be daggered plus, well, that's the only term I would need to write down. Now you might guess, and you'd guess correctly, if you were to write down, so this is just a guess for one term based on a matrix element, I'm not giving you a very systematic argument yet. You might guess that there should be, this was coming from a W, right? And the W couples, if I just pull out all the terms in the Lagrange, all the fermion interactions proportional to a W coupling, I've got my, and sorry, here I need to put in, no, that's right, this is for the W minus. The W minus couples to a mu gamma mu p left nu plus e gamma mu p left, sorry, this is the W plus, as I'm writing, sorry, e bar gamma mu p left nu e plus whatever other fermions I want to keep track of. Right now, I just want to keep track of the muon and the electron, so I'm done. If I called this whole thing the current J plus, it has plus one charge, mu, you might expect this effective Lagrangian to really take the form of a G2 squared over 2MW squared. J plus dagger of mu. So far, so plausible. I'm going to actually derive this later. So if you don't buy it, that's fine, because that's the next thing I'm going to do. But any questions so far? Yeah?
So this term would be just one term in that Lagrangian, right?
Right. So I was trying, so this would be one term in the interaction Lagrangian, and if I wrote this down, it would contain this as well as terms that have, for example,
squared.
Two muon, right, this guy squared, that guy squared, which would give me muon neutrino scattering through charged currents. I'm also not trying to write down right now the Z part. Okay, so where does this come from, and how can we actually systematically calculate that? This form of the effect of Lagrangian. So I'm not going to do it for the standard model. Oh, yeah, sorry.
Are those two pluses? J plus, J plus, two plus the
term? I wrote it as J plus dagger, which we'd usually call J minus. So it should be one positive and one negative. I'm going to sketch out how to derive that in a different, in a simpler model. So I'm going to abstract from the standard model to just a model with one Dirac fermion and one massive vector. Okay, a lot simpler, a lot fewer indices for me to write down wrong on the board. Where f mu nu, as usual, for a u1 is just that. And d slash psi stands for del slash plus iga slash psi. By the way, you'll notice that I've written here a Lagrangian with a massive gauge boson and no Higgs. So do you guys know this, that this is a totally consistent theory for U1, but not for non-abelian theory? Okay. Yeah, so this is just kind of a cool fact. You can write down a Lagrangian for massive, this is a Lagrangian for a massive U1 vector boson. That's it, I didn't put in a Higgs. I'm not saying that there was a symmetry that got Higgs, I just wrote it down. You can ask, is there anything sick and wrong about this theory? You can calculate scattering amplitudes to your heart's content, see if you get a violation of unitarity. You don't. Looks perfectly healthy. If you tried to do the same thing for a non-abelian theory without a Higgs, do you know what would go wrong? So, in a non-abelian theory, these Fs really have this extra term, right? If it were non-abelian, I'd have terms that go like a mu, a nu, in f mu nu. Sorry, didn't mean to erase that, in f mu nu. So this kinetic term would come and bring along with it some interactions. I could calculate things like WW scattering through those interactions, etc. And the amplitude that I calculate would just grow and grow and grow at large energies. If I calculated it wrong, it would go like e to the fourth over m to the fourth. Then you calculate it right, and you realize that the e to the fourth is canceling. But you're still left with an e squared over m squared type of growth. So you'd say, this theory is just becoming strongly coupled. I don't understand its dynamics. Above a mass scale, the scale where it would really become non-perturbative, where loops and tree diagrams all start having sort of equal sizes and you just don't know what's going on, the cutoff for that theory would be, I believe it's like 4 pi over g, times the mass of the W. I'm not totally sure of whether I got the power right there. So for a non-abelian theory, like the standard model, we have an SU2, you just know that there has to be something responsive, some that the theory has to break down at some scale. This is why we can get funding to build an LHC, in part, because there was a really good argument that there had to be a Higgs or Technicolor or something, because the theory just didn't make sense above at high energies. But had we just had a U1, we wouldn't have known. Could have written down a theory without a Higgs. Yeah?
So are you saying that if your theory has in fact engaged bosons, you need to have something like the Higgs boson?
Yeah, something like. So it could be, and I mean interacting in the way that non-abelian gauge theories do, right? So an interaction that's a marginal, that has a renormalizable coupling. Yeah.
So when we put the mass term, it would be wrong to call it a gauge boson because the gauge symmetry is no longer there, right?
Yes. So you can restore the gauge boson. There's a nice trick called the Stueckelberg trick that I should skip for lack of time. But this is a key difference between abelian and non-abelian structures. One massive spin one boson not interacting, totally fine, no need for a Higgs. Now I emphasized something like a Higgs in answer to your question, because it doesn't have to be a Higgs. We talked about how if there was no Higgs, we could still get massive W's and Z's in the standard model because of confinement of QCD. No fundamental Higgs, there that quark, left-right quark condensate would be actually serving the role of the Higgs. So it doesn't have to be a fundamental Higgs particle. The analog of that people proposed early on, the second proposal for how we could have massive W's and Z's in the world, was actually that there was something just like the little QCD, but at higher energies, and that was Technicolor. Doesn't literally have to be a Higgs, but we knew there had to be something just by self-consistency of the theory. Here, we can just write down a mass square and be done. Okay, so now, might have to be a little bit quick through this or finish it up next time, but I think this is actually simple enough. Does the next class start at 10?
It starts at 10 to 15, I think.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah,
so so it's okay if I go until 10 sharp? Or?
Yeah.
Good. Okay. So, so I can expand him out. I'm going to go ahead and just do a few tricks on this Lagrangian. So the first thing I'll do is I'm going to expand out this and write separately, separate the A term, the interaction, from the kinetic term. So I've got my kinetic term. That involves just my light fermion, not my heavy gauge boson. I'm going to integrate out A. And again, you're right, Tipper, I shouldn't be calling him a gauge boson, my heavy spin one boson. And then I've got my term, and I'm just going to call this G A mu J mu, where J mu is just my psi bar I gamma mu psi. Okay, so I'm going to focus on the A, not on the psi, when I manipulate him. Now this kinetic term I can expand out as a half, minus a half. There's a del mu A nu squared minus del mu A nu del nu A mu. And then I've got my mass term. And so finally, I can now take all of these terms. So that's my kinetic term and my mass term. They're both quadratic in A. This guy's linear in A. So I can just group these. So my A mu, J mu. And then minus a half, I'm going to write this, integrating by parts in the action, I can write this as a g mu nu del squared minus, from him I'm going to get a del mu del nu minus g mu nu m squared times an a nu upper index. Okay, so I've just massaged these guys by integrating with my parts. And then, having done that, let me just call this guy, give him a name, d inverse mu nu. This operator is inverted by the propagator. If you work out, so the propagator, delta mu nu, is same thing I wrote down earlier, but now I'll write it, well, yeah, let me mark in momentum space, so I look at its Fourier transform, p mu, p nu, over m squared, over p squared minus m squared, and if I look at the Fourier transform to momentum space of this operator, d inverse, the one I defined right here, and I multiply that by delta nu rho of p, that just gives me back a delta function. Okay, so that means that I can introduce, that I can write a, you know, I can insert d delta, d inverse of delta, anywhere in this expression that I want. Now, up to now, it's not very clear why I'm doing all of this. So why did I just rewrite my Lagrangian that way? If we think about the path integral, right, so I'm calculating z, some path integral over psi and over the field A times e to the I action. And we know that at low energies, our theory is just a theory of psi. So what I want to do is some formal manipulations so that I can integrate out this field A, just integrate over it in the path integral. Because we know if we're studying low energy scattering, there's not physical A's that we're ever producing. I should be able to talk about the physics of psi without the physics of A. So the way to do that is first to write the Lagrangian in this quadratic form. Then, having done that, formally I can complete the square in terms of my operator delta. I could write this as psi bar d slash psi plus, minus a half a mu minus, I think, g j mu times d inverse. I need a delta mu nu j nu d inverse of an A, so this will have a mu rho, A rho minus g delta rho sigma j sigma. If I expand out the linear term here, so the quadratic term in A's is just the quadratic term I had up there. The linear term, once I contract these deltas into the d's, yet turn those into delta functions on the indices, Kronecker deltas on the indices, I'm going to get back from the two linear terms him. Of course, I've just completed the square. I need to do the usual subtraction of a half g squared. And now I'm left with one spare delta mu nu J mu that I need to add back in. And I think I made a sign error somewhere. That should have a minus sign on it in the final answer, but who's counting? So now, this is the only place in my action that A appears. So I can go ahead and do a change of variables in the path integral, let A go to this object, this combination here, call this thing A tilde. And then I've got an integral d psi dA tilde e to the I integral d4x of my Lagrangian, which is just psi bar d slash psi A tilde d inverse mu rho A tilde j squared over 2 delta mu nu j mu j nu. And A tilde only appears here. It's a Gaussian term. I can just do that integral. This is equal to some formal Gaussian integral object, some formal determinant. Formally, I can call it the determinant of that symbol. Times the thing I really care about, that's actually gonna model the dynamics of my psi, d psi e to the I times, call him L effective, where L effective is just psi bar d slash psi plus g squared delta mu nu over 2 j mu j nu. And now, if I'm working at small momenta, I can do now exactly the same approximation I did when I was doing the muon decay. But now I'm doing it in the action, right? I'm not doing it for a specific process. I'm doing it totally generally. I can say delta mu nu is approximately equal to g mu nu over mw squared. And then L effective is approximately g squared over 2mw squared j squared, which is exactly the form, the same form that I'm motivated over here, right? Here I was doing it for a single abelian vector coupled to a real current. So I just get j squared, not a j plus j minus. But I hope it's easy to see how this would extend to the full standard model-like case. You just have a lot more details to keep track of when you complete this work. All right, so that's it for now. I'll talk more, I guess, about the standard model in addition to doing flavor tomorrow. And yeah, lots of questions, so shoot.
And so where did we use the cutoff?
Sorry?
Where did we use that we're working with an effective?
Ah, very good. Sorry, it was this last step here. So if I went through this a little more slowly, I could take delta mu nu, and this the full expression for delta mu nu up there. I can Taylor expand in P over M, right? And I'd have my g mu nu over M squared minus, you know, P mu, P nu over M to the fourth. And then there would be another term that looks like a g mu nu p squared over m to the fourth from Taylor expanding the denominator, and so on, right? And it's this, what we're doing, formally the all orders Taylor expansion is the same as that object, but what we're doing is we're then just keeping the first term.
Oh, so we can only integrate out to a tilde after doing this approximation?
Well, we can integrate it out beforehand, but what we're left with is this. This is the effective Lagrangian that has a delta mu nu, and this is a momentum-dependent operator. Okay, so I was a bit sloppy here, but really what I'd have here is a j mu in Fourier space, a j nu in Fourier space. So this is the Fourier component with momentum p, the Fourier component with momentum minus p. And this is an operator that involves lots of p's in both the numerator and the denominator. So I can't write that as a local operator in position space. I have to write it out in momentum space that way. What I did, where I used the cutoff, is in saying, okay, I'm interested in low momenta, so let me Taylor expand that. Then once you write it as a Taylor expansion, every term in the Taylor expansion can be written, it just has a finite number of momenta in the numerator. I can write those as derivatives, right? And now I can go back and write this guy is just the term that I wrote down here. this guy has two derivatives acting on each current, on one of the currents, or I can put them on whatever current I want just by integrating my parts. This guy also has two derivatives acting on the currents, right? So there's actually a tower of different operators, but there's infinitely many of them. And because they're suppressed by momentum over relative to this guy, these ones are suppressed by p squared over m squared. The next ones up are suppressed by p to the fourth over m to the fourth. So as the momentum gets close to the mass, those are breaking down. And physically, what they're encoding is actually the fact that there's a pole there, right? It's breaking down because I'm Taylor expanding near the pole of the function. But as long as I'm expanding at momenta that are small, I'm dominated by this guy, or if I want to be more precise, I can include the next two terms, for example. And these truncated Taylor expansions are nice local functions. So I'm using the momentum much smaller than the mass in order to justify doing a Taylor series expansion and keeping a finite number of terms.
Is it at this level already clear that these momenta will be small?
No. Well, so when I say this, so this is a formally correct but very non-local expression. This approximation here, I'm just asserting, I'm going to make an approximation that is only valid for momentum, for the current momentum squared much less than the mass squared. And then once I've made that approximation, I have an object that I know I shouldn't use outside of the domain of validity of the approximation. Right? So, and by the way, the theory is telling me that I shouldn't use it far above mass of the W squared, because let's say that I did take this truncation. I just use this interaction. At high momenta, each current has a derivative in it, right? So at high momenta, this is going like momentum squared. And at momenta large compared to m squared, this guy here goes like p squared over m squared. And it gets strongly coupled, right? So precisely when I go far outside the domain of validity here, this interaction gets strongly coupled, and the effective theory says to you, wait a minute, I don't make sense anymore. You probably shouldn't be trusting me because my couplings are blowing up. There might be a lot of other things that you need to include. Sure enough, in the full theory, that mw squared becomes an mw, a p squared minus m squared, and starts getting, and it ends up not, the amplitudes don't diverge, because that delta at high momenta goes like 1 over p squared. Hopefully that cleared things up rather than confusing them more. Any more questions?
I was just going to ask about spirion.
Yeah.
So we have to do a kaon decay into two pions in the last course, and we have to use a spirion method to argue that it was a correct Hamiltonian.
Right.
It didn't seem very convincing, so I was wondering if there's a more formal way of doing that.
So this was where you had to put in a matrix sort of that knew what the neutral currents were, or which.
Well,
so first you'll have to tell me why you found it unconvincing.
Well, you were trying to say that it was invariant under the symmetry, but you were sort of pretending that it was invariant under that symmetry.
Right. So you can always. So the spurion in that case, is this the charged W interaction spurion or a different one? Okay, so my suggestion actually is let's talk, when we talk about flavor next week, I'll be introducing lots of spurions, and I'll know exactly which spurions I'm talking about. So you can complain about them, and then we can talk about those spurions, or we can talk after class as well about the kaon problem. But since I don't remember off the top of my head, it's not going to be a very constructive discussion. Anything else? You guys can talk to me after class as well. I'll stick around for a few minutes.